Before you begin,
yes, sir.
Before I turn on the clock, I
yes,
want
sir.
To, with the permission of my colleagues, I want to ask each side a question about the timing of this case.
Yes, sir.
We know, of course, from what we've read, that the issues have been around for a while. And we wanted to make you aware that, given the timing of the expediting of this case, the beginning of the Labor Day weekend, our ability to only assemble a panel of three, what is the necessity for action by what date from us, and what is the press of time that causes us to have an emergency? It's also for us awkward because we cannot make staff stay over the weekend, and if we were able to, we couldn't pay them, in accordance with the law. And it's a transition day with our law clerks. This is the last day for a year of law clerks. Tomorrow is the first day. So if you want to talk about a list of calamities from our point of view, the timing here is exquisite. So we need to know what is the pressure on you. We appreciate, of course, what you all have gone through with what you believe to be the demands of your clients. But give us a better feel for the timing of a decision from us and the detail of that decision.
Certainly. Your Honor, from our perspective, and we appear on behalf of Niagara Corporation, which was the defendant below, we don't have a time pressure that requires a decision by the court in any particular time. We took the appeal, I think, within the applicable time period, and believe it should be reversed, but I don't think we feel that there's an urgency that has to be decided by a particular time.
Well, when is there an impending mootness?
Yes, sir. Well, there's a stockholders meeting on a proposed transaction that's set for September the 6th, and stockholders will be given an opportunity at that time to vote on a proposed transaction, and I understand that counsel has taken the position that they have concerns about the mootness issue, and indeed the court below did as well, which is why we proceeded on the track that we did proceed on. From our perspective, we think reversal is appropriate, and it could happen on whatever schedule that the justices are comfortable with.
Again, the clock's not on, so this is a non-merits administrative discussion.
I'm Michael Weidinger, Your Honor, on behalf of Winfield. We apologize for the inconvenience of the court.
But it's not that we're inconvenienced. We're embarrassed that the situation puts us where it does. It's not anything you need to apologize for. We just want to do the best job we can for you, but with the constraints that we have, we need to know just how much pressure is on us.
September 6th, as Mr. Welch indicated, is the time for the vote on a transaction that has been announced. The question that we have is what disclosures would the stockholders properly be entitled to in connection with that vote as it relates to the reporting obligations that they may or may not have had, the discovery of which has been sought throughout this books and records case. So the issue really for us is there disclosures that are going to be set forth to the stockholders in connection with the September 6th vote adequate?
Well, I took it from your earlier papers that if you were to be successful, you would still need time in order to examine what was delivered to you between now and the 6th. Is that true or not true?
We would need some time, but our concern was that we would need sufficient time to be able to get on file by September the 6th an action that would preserve our rights either to an injunction or in hearing on an injunction to stop that transaction, which is required, as I understand it, under the documents, Mr. Watson, correct me if I'm wrong, by October, that would permit us to either obtain an injunction or, at a minimum, preserve our right to a claim for rescission or rescissory damages.
Okay, and your response to any question about mootness?
Well, our response with respect to the question of mootness is when the transaction closes, any of the derivative claims that might have proceeded in connection with the documents that we had sought will be extinguished.
Okay.
Undoubtedly the case.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
The only point I might add to that, Your Honor, is obviously the proxy materials have been out there for a considerable period of time now. There has been no challenge to the disclosures in the proxy materials. And beyond that, I would also note that these same issues were ventilated before Vice Chancellor Lamb in 2005 in December, the same substantive issues. So,
okay. Well, yes, let's start the clock and turn to the merits, Mr. Welch.
Yes, sir. May it please the Court, I'm Edward Welch from Skadden-Arps, Slate, Barr, and Flom. I appear on behalf of the appellant Niagara Corporation. This is an appeal in a Section 220 books and records case. The appellee Winfield demanded books and records of Niagara Steel with respect to two broad categories. Number one, deregistration of Niagara stock, and number two, a purported duty to re-register. Because this is a books and records case, it's plaintiff's burden by a preponderance to show a credible basis of probable wrongdoing. The Security First makes that very clear, the decision of this Court, and that is a not insubstantial burden.
What is the scope of the term wrongdoing? Does it mean simply common law fiduciary duty violations, or does it extend to any otherwise authorized action that may, in its implementation, violate federal statutes?
I don't know that there's a decision on that, Mr. Justice Steele, but I believe, obviously, the Court below felt that if there was a problem under the federal securities laws, and they thought the Court thought there might have been, that would suffice. And I understand that position. That's the only case
I
know.
Is there any precedent that draws a line between the two? Or
no, sir.
Not the concept of wrongdoing, just whatever the dictionary definition is?
Your Honor, I do not know of any authority on that. Obviously, it's our position that there was no wrongdoing of any type.
No, I understand.
And
that.
I do want to address that. But obviously, this Court, as Vice Chancellor Lamb pointed out, pardon me, in his decision on the TRL in 2005, this Court doesn't have jurisdiction, subject matter jurisdiction, to construe the Exchange Act or, for that matter, the rules promulgated thereunder, including Section 10b-17, or I'm sorry, Rule 10b-17. The Court below obviously undertook some analysis of that in making the state law determination. That's what I think, and we obviously appeal from that and believe that was wrong.
What record, other than Vice Chancellor Lamb's order for the reasons stated on the record, do we have of what his actual decision is?
Well, Mr. Justice Ridgely, there was an opinion that appeared as a bench ruling in a transcript, which has been forwarded to the Court. It's in the appendix. I apologize off the top of my head. I don't recall the exact, but it's towards the end of the entries in Volume 3 of our appendix.
All right.
But he does, and I also would add that in addition to the formal presentation at the end of that hearing, he also addresses throughout the hearing his views, and some of those are quoted in our briefs. The Court below rejected the demand for documents with respect to deregistration. The Court found no credible basis of wrongdoing. I would like to discuss that later. The Court below found a credible basis for inspection regarding a potential duty to re-register, and I would like to address that first. concluding that Niagara might have to re-register, the court focused on three provisions of the federal securities law. My apologies to the Court. Section 15D of the Exchange Act, Section 12G of the Exchange Act, and Rule 10b-17. We believe that the Court below got it wrong on all three of those points. The same arguments were made to Vice Chancellor Lamb in December of 2005. We believe that Vice Chancellor Lamb got it right on all three of those points. Let me take the first one first, which is Section 15D of the Exchange.
Before you get into that, did anyone argue to Vice Chancellor Parsons that that ruling was somehow the law of the case and that he had to, because if the law of the case applies, a successive judge can't disregard the prior ruling unless the prior ruling was clearly wrong?
We certainly argued to him, Your Honor, that the conclusions of Vice Chancellor Lamb were absolutely correct with respect to all three of these provisions of the federal securities laws. It arose in a different context. One was a temporary restraining order addressed to the 2005 splits. This case was addressed to the 2004 splits. The legal issues, however, were the same, and we did point that out to him, to Vice Chancellor Parsons.
Well, but Justice Holland's question is, did you argue that it was the law of the case, and did he respond to that?
Well, we did not argue that it was the law of the case. It was presented, Mr. Justice Steele, in the context of a temporary restraining order. We argued that he was correct, but we did not use that formal argument that it was the law of the case. Let me first, if I could, address Section 15D. The court below found a credible basis for concluding that Niagara had a duty to re-register its stock under Section 15D because Niagara had 300 or more stockholders on the first day of its fiscal year, which is what Section 15D addresses. Now, Niagara did a number of stock splits at the end of 2004. That reduced the number of shareholders that were outstanding. Why did it do that? Well, the answer was because Winfield, the appellee here, was distributing shares of stock in an effort to drive up the number of stockholders so as to force Niagara to re-register. Niagara saved more money in deregistering in the first year than it made in certain prior years. This was an important event for Niagara. So Niagara did the stock splits in order to protect that deregistration. Now, with respect to those stock splits in 2004, what happened? Well, Niagara's stock list showed 421 stockholders at the end of 2004. On December 31st, the reverse stock split took place. That reduced the number of record owners down to 83. So thus, Niagara had 83 holders of record at the beginning of its fiscal year in the beginning of 2005. 83 is less than 300. Therefore, there was no duty to re-register its stock under Section 15D of the Exchange Act. Very importantly for this court, the SEC has heard extensively from our opposition about this issue. The SEC has never asserted that Niagara had any duty to re-register its stock. Now, the opinion at page 33 below agreed that whether or not there was a credible basis of wrongdoing hinged on whether Winfield presented evidence, and this court requires evidence in the 220 case, that the splits occurred after January 1 of 2005. The court made two errors. They were profound errors. The first was that the court failed to conclude that Section 103D of our own corporation law dictates that the splits occurred on December 31, 2004. And secondly, for every piece of evidence that the court considered, it shifted the burden to Niagara. That is plain error under Section 220.
When was notice given to NASDAQ of the splits?
Your Honor, there's nothing in the record on that at this point. I can go outside the record, but there's nothing in the record. That's the 10b-17 issue, which I would definitely want to address. Vice Chancellor Lamb found that 10b-17 didn't even apply here. I would like to address that, but no notice that I can think of in advance of the splits. Certainly there's nothing in the record on that point. And our position is there was nothing required. Vice Chancellor Lamb, so help.
Now, with regard to this statutory argument, is there any implication of the internal affairs doctrine? I mean, your argument is Delaware law controls.
Yes, sir.
The 31st should have been the date.
Yes, sir. Mr. Justice Holland, there is every implication of the internal affairs doctrine. That doctrine under McDermott against Lewis says that Delaware law controls the internal affairs of a Delaware corporation unless there's something else outside in the form of preemption that would require federal law to apply. There was no evidence cited below. There was no authority cited below of any authority of the SEC, of NASD, or any other regulatory authority to reset the effective date of a stock split under Delaware law.
There's a phrase that recurs in your opponent's brief, and I think I can get it right. It's the phrase effective in the market. What does that mean?
Your Honor,
that a term of art that
Your Honor,
I'm not a,
not to my knowledge. I don't know. Now, what we do know is that there was analysis done. There were changes made when you do a split with respect to the name and symbol. Now that happens, no doubt about that, and that takes a little bit longer to happen. The regulatory authorities take some time to make the name and symbol change happen. Vice Chancellor Parsons respectfully focused on certain documents that dealt with that and erred in doing so in thinking that there was some federal delay of the split. There was no federal delay of the effectiveness of this split. The number of stockholders, because of 103D, and by the way, that was the only evidence in the case of the effective date of the splits, our own Secretary of State saying they happen on December 31st of 2004, there was no evidence of anything to the contrary.
Well, then your response is effective in the market really has no legal meaning?
Well, my response, Mr. Justice Steele, would be it's effective in the market under Delaware law because Delaware law controls this. It was effective in our judgment. I don't know what they meant. What I do know It was effective in the market because Delaware law controls on December 31st of 2004 when our Secretary of State said it was effective. There is no authority that contradicts that. None cited by the court below, by the opposing parties below.
So your position is it was effective on the 31st, and if it took the market a few days to catch up with what happened, that doesn't negate the effectiveness.
Yes, sir. Yeah, Mr. Justice Holland, I would agree with that. Of course not. And that makes sense. That it takes time when you're changing the symbol, you're changing the name, you're doing – there's administrative aspects to that. That can take some time. Indeed, the number of shareholders had been shrunk to 83. It's not even surprising. Our opponents point out that there wasn't trading on one of the days in the first week of January. Hardly a surprise. There were only, again, 83 stockholders. In the prior days, there was a few trades made, but again, that doesn't matter either. Stockholders were free to trade, and the regulatory authorities were free to focus on the name and symbol change as they dealt with, as they saw appropriate.
So if your argument prevails with regard to the effectiveness of December 31st, that addresses two of the three sections of the federal securities law, because clearly there, if you have 83 shareholders, that's less than 300 and it's less than 500.
Yes, sir.
And consequently, if that is determinative as a matter of law, they're not entitled to production on those two bases, which would leave us with the third ground, which is no 10-day notice that Vice Chancellor Lamb addressed, and what he said was, if it's effective immediately, it's not one of those provisions that requires 10 days notice.
Yes, sir. Mr. Justice Holland, that summarizes exactly. I'll jump to 10b-17 if I could. The court also below erred in finding that NASDAQ may have suspended trading in Niagara stock because there was a failure to provide a 10b-17 notice. There's a number of answers to that, and they are powerful. 10b-17 requires advanced 10-day notice of a record date for a split. As Your Honor just pointed out, as Vice Chancellor Lamb held below, Niagara splits were approved by the board on the same day that they happened. There was no record date as such. Vice Chancellor Lamb said that there was no record date. There was just an effective date when it all happened. Now, more importantly, I think, because Vice Chancellor Lamb's decision, again, is I think, very clear on that point, but the court below here erred in finding that there may have been an alleged trading stop on January the 7th, because there was no trading on that day. Now, it's interesting. The court noted in its opinion that NASDAQ could stop trading if it wanted to. The problem is, if you read the rules, it's very clear. You require, there's a public notice that's required before NASDAQ will do that. There's no evidence whatsoever of any public notice. We know of no public notice. No public notice was ever directed to our attention. We've seen public notices applicable to other corporations. Never, never applicable to Niagara. So that was plain error.
Help me see if I understand the record. This relates to my question about the market catching up with what happened legally.
Yes, sir.
As I understand it, it's your position that if things stopped trading, it's because the deregistration was effective and it had nothing to do with anybody entering an order.
Well, it can still trade, Your Honor. Deregistration avoids the expense of SEC filings and that sort of thing. It still traded over the counter, so stockholders could trade. However, and their focus is on the first week of January, this one day when stockholders having been reduced to 83 in number, there was no trading. Again, hardly a shock. Their burden of proof to show that there was something else out there. There was nothing else out there. There was no NASD, NASDAQ, SEC, or any other kind of direction stopping trading. So respectfully to the court below, I think that was plain error to predicate its analysis of 10b-17 on some guess that perhaps a stop trading order was entered, which order was never introduced in evidence in the record. And indeed, the reason for that is it didn't exist. So we believe that was plain error. The other thing that I think that's important to be mindful of with respect to the 10b-17 argument is this. There is nothing in 10b-17 whatsoever that authorizes the resetting of the effective date of a split. There's nothing in 10b-17 that does that. It says, well, you should give 10 days notice if you're going to have a record date, and that's all well and good.
But if you violate 10b-17, that's by itself is a manipulative or deceptive device or contrivance under Section 10b, right?
If one did, and of course Vice Chancellor Lamb, Mr. Justice Ridgely, found that we didn't, and we believe that was a correct finding. But in terms of the predicate for the court's decision that there was a stop trading, there's nothing in 10b-17 whatsoever that supports that. There's no authority given to the SEC, and notwithstanding entreaties by our opposition to have the SEC act time after time after time, the SEC never took any action against Niagara here. The NASDAQ never took any action against Niagara here. And again, I think the bottom line is there's no authority, aside from the fact that no action was ever taken, under any federal statute to reset a record date set by Delaware, to set a split date properly set under Delaware law, Section 103 of the Delaware General Corporation Law. I see I'm heading into my reply time. Mr. Justice Steele, I'd like to preserve a little time, so I
will fine.
Conclude at this point.
May it please the court. I'll make two basic points. First, the court did not err in awarding Winfield documents related to the effectiveness of the reverse and forward splits. And second, the court did err in setting what I consider to be a high bar for the establishment, too high a bar for the establishment of proof of credible basis for wrongdoing with respect to the decision to go dark and the denial of certain of the documents that we requested. And I will start with the stock list, Your Honor.
Before you get to that, one way of reading your brief is that that's moot. Is that still an issue before us?
It is an issue before, Your Honor, with respect to the DTC participant list.
You've never gotten that?
I've never gotten that. I have not received the DTC participant list for December 31st, 2004 through January 7, 2005. That is the participant list that is necessary for us to determine the number of record stockholders that Niagara had for securities law purposes, and those are the lists that have not yet been delivered to us.
What does this mean in your brief on page 26, your answering brief? Finally, Niagara has effectively waived any complaint about turning over the DTC participant list.
They gave us the transfer records that they purported in a letter to us to have satisfied our demand for the stock list. They did that coincident with turning over the transfer records. When they turned over those transfer records, they failed to give us the DTC participant list. That participant list is part and parcel of a stock list under Delaware law. When you ask for a stock list, what you need is, and what you're entitled to get, is the same records that the corporation has available through it, to it. That includes the DTC participant list. So when they wrote us a letter and said, we're satisfying your demand for the stock list, here it is for these dates, they should have given us the participant list.
How do you respond to the argument in Mr. Welch's brief that clearly you're entitled to get it if you asked for it, but you didn't ask for it? You seem to be saying, as a matter of law, your broad request included the DTC list implicitly. Is that correct?
That's correct for two reasons. One, it really goes to the purposes for which the list was requested. We asked for two reasons. One was to communicate with stockholders, and that's one of the reasons you get the DTC participant list. And two, in order for us to be able to count the record number of stockholders that existed for federal securities law purposes. We need that list in order to do those, and it's part and parcel of a request for a list to have provided it to us.
Was that issue tried by express or implied consent in the case? In other words, was this the DTC list was part of the evidence and argument before the Vice Chancellor? Or did he come up with that on his own in the opinion for the first time?
Well, the DTC participant list was always a part of the case. We had always been seeking that. There was a question as to whether or not, because counsel had argued we had not properly also asked for a current stock list. That issue was mooted when they did turn over to us later that DTC participant list for a later date. That later date was the date that was commensurate with the then pending annual meeting of stockholders.
So you have the later DTC list, and what you want is the earlier one.
What I want is the earlier ones, and it's the earlier ones that will enable us to establish the number of record holders for security law counting purposes.
And you think with that list and with the stockholder list that you have, that you have a credible complaint that there were more than 300 shareholders or more than 500 shareholders on December 31st?
With that list and with the other documents that the court ordered be produced, yes.
Now, if the forward and reverse split was effective on December 31st, do you agree that there were less than 300 shareholders at the end of the day?
At the as of January 1, 2005, which is the day that matters for purposes of the relevant rule, the answer to that question is yes. If that was effective on the 31st for securities law purposes, then we don't have, there's 83 stockholders.
Right. So then the second question is, why shouldn't the Delaware statute control the effective date for all purposes?
Well, it's interesting because I think counsel relied on a number of places, the findings by Vice Chancellor Lamb, or the rulings by Vice Chancellor Lamb. Look at the transcript of Vice Chancellor Lamb. He made a number of comments about the federal law and federal securities laws and what effect they may or may not be given. But what he did clearly state on the record is, I have no jurisdiction to decide those matters. I'm not making a finding at all with respect to these matters. In fact, I had argued that he should at least consider state law for purposes of the claims that I was making at that time on the temporary restraining order. And he said, no, it's a question of federal law. I don't have jurisdiction to interpret that statute.
He could have said, applying the internal affairs doctrine, I think that this is a matter that's so interrelated with the relationship between stockholders and the board that the internal affairs doctrine applies, and as a matter of Delaware law, the effective date's the 31st, and that pursuant to the internal affairs doctrine, federal courts would honor it.
He didn't say that. He didn't rule that, certainly not law of the case, that that's the rule. Because, as counsel pointed out in response to your question, there may be some question of preemption. Stockholders did not get notice of when this split was going to occur consistent with federal law. The 10b-17 notice is required for a stock split to be sent 10 days to the NASD prior to the split. All of the record evidence suggests that that did not happen in the as it's required to under federal law.
But as I understand Vice Chancellor Lamb's ruling, he says you only send it if you have a prospective effective date, and if you do something that's effective immediately, that you don't have to send a notice.
That's not what the rule says. The rule says 10 days prior to the
record date.
The record date for an event, a split or otherwise, you have to file the notice.
And
but they've argued
that
no
record date is the same day, though. Are you saying that that's an impossibility?
The rule doesn't require that. Doesn't permit it. The record date is day. The way this would normally have worked is that 10 days prior to December 31st. Niagara would have given notice to the NASDAQ. We're doing a split on December the 31st. The market would have had notice. The record date is December 31st. The effective date of that split is December 31st, and they would have filed at the same time the certificate with the Secretary of State of Delaware. They did a number of those things, but what they didn't do was send to the NASDAQ the required 10b-17 notice.
Well, your opponent says that the date of any notice is not in the record. Is it in the record?
No, that's a document that we've sought. The 10b-17 notice is a document that we sought. What is in the record is the public documents that show changes to the OTCBB reporting system that effective, that the document was filed, the notice was provided, and notice went out into the marketplace on December the 6th at 4:58 p.m. for a split that's effective the next day, January the 7th. Now, they
January.
Now, they read those documents and say, oh, that's just a name change. That's just a symbol change. That doesn't have any effect to when the split is effective. And with due respect, that's an ultimate question for a finder of fact and law in federal court.
Well, and let's stay with that for a moment. What, if anything, should we make of the fact that the record demonstrates your clients had at least 18 contacts with the SEC? You told them about all of the alleged violations, including this 10B17 violation. Here we are a couple of years later, many months later, and we have no record of any action being taken by the SEC.
I don't think you can make any inference adverse to Winfield on that. There are a couple of points with respect to it. The positions are taken by the SEC were by staff of the SEC. There's no written opinion that this is the way in which the SEC itself, the commission, interprets the rule. What you have is some statements by staff of the position that they would take if Winfield brought this on either to them, or brought it on to them. But it's also the case, as Mr. Nelson testified, that there are other reasonable interpretations of the statute that could be brought before a court and ultimately decided that the SEC staff interpretation position taken in verbal statements to Mr. Nelson, which are in the record, is incorrect. It's also the case, as he testified, that the SEC may or may not choose to use enforcement authority to do anything against Niagara. That's its choice. It's discretionary.
At the end of the day, let's suppose you can clearly demonstrate this 10B17 violation. What are you seeking?
Well, at that point, if we were able to get the documents and we would be able to establish a violation of 10B17, that would provide the predicate for claims under the federal securities laws under 10B5. Whether we ultimately determine to bring such claims obviously hasn't been decided. It depends on what the records show and whether or not at that time my client wants to pursue them. But
is there any evidence in the record now of financial harm to the corporation or personal gain to any individual director as a result of the NASDAQ action saying the effective date was in January?
That specific harm, no. The question that's been raised is the company delisted. It was back in April. It filed its Form 15. It's effective 90 days thereafter. It's now deregistered from the NASDAQ, and its stock only trades in a less liquid market called the pink sheets. That's the over-the-counter market. So the issue with respect to the harm that was suffered in connection with this transaction is that they set the price at which was paid in the split based on the trading price of a relatively less liquid security that traded only on the pink sheets. Mr. Nelson, who had testified regarding the manner in which OTCB reviews the documents and the circumstances regarding what happened with the splits, also happens to be counsel to pink sheets, which is in the record. The 10B17 notice, in addition to the public documents suggesting that notice was filed on the 6th for an effective split the next day, there is hearsay testimony.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Welch. Throughout your brief, you referred to the term effective in the market.
What
does that mean to you?
What I mean by that is that the stockholders had effective notice of it. I did not want to go so far as to say that it definitively means that the effective date of these splits for all purposes, whether it be securities law purposes or Delaware purposes, is the 7th, because that's a legal determination that hasn't yet been made. And
that's one that apparently our courts aren't prepared to make under federal law.
That's the way I read Vice Chancellor Lamb's ruling on the TRO papers, yes.
But we are in a position to make a determination about whether the reverse forward split was effective under Delaware law on December 31st, 2004, or not.
Well, this is a books and records case seeking the documents that would be able to establish that. It's undoubtedly the case that it was filed on December the 31st, 2004. So on its face, it could be given effectiveness as of that date. However, there are, if documents show to the contrary.
And you conceded that if it were, there would be fewer than 500 and fewer than 300 shareholders that day.
That is correct. That is correct. But the effectiveness of that is what's being challenged in this case. To say that the filing of a certificate would end the equitable inquiry as to whether or not it was truly effective against the stockholders and the public for all purposes, including federal securities law.
Why is that an equitable inquiry rather than a legal one?
Well, I think there are circumstances where, for example, certificates of amendment, which turn out to be wrong, certificates that are filed, which turn out to be wrong, can be corrected. And when they're corrected, they have effect of the date that they're corrected. But they're not good against people who didn't have notice and were adversely affected between the time the certificate was first filed and the time it's subsequently corrected. That's the kind of analysis that I'm referring to. Would be an equitable inquiry as to the stockholders, the effect on the stockholders, who that notice, who that amendment would be effective against when it was initially filed, who it might be effective against later date. Those are all questions that I don't think can be decided until we get an opportunity to look at the records, see exactly what happened, and determine whether or not we want to bring on any claims for violations of either federal securities laws or potentially breach of fiduciary duty.
Do you have any case law that suggests that the term credible evidence of wrongdoing, or just the term wrongdoing, applies to a 220 action and a Delaware judge determining whether wrongdoing encompasses a possible, probable, or actual violation of federal securities law?
I do not. I do not. By inference, I think we've all argued, the judge agreed that it would be mismanagement, it would be a probable violation of law, or would be wrongdoing if, for example, the 10B17 notice wasn't filed on time, which the federal securities law say is a manipulative device. And I think it's by analogy, there are provisions, for instance, 102B7, if you make some knowing violation of the law, whatever that law would be, maybe the securities violations, you wouldn't be exculpated for breach of the duty of loyalty. I'll turn, the only portion of the securities laws that I haven't dealt with is the 12G section, which is the 500 at the end of the year. I mentioned that we asked for the participant list, and we need that participant list in order to demonstrate it. The court, I think, properly granted our access to it for a number of reasons, including that not only it's part of the stock list, but also that the transfer list itself does not give effect to the splits, as Niagara says they happened at the close of business. The transfer agent's records show 421. If that reverse split had been effective as of the close of business on December 31st, that transfer list on that date would show only 83 stockholders, as it does later on January 3rd.
And what did the Vice Chancellor mean when he said 488 is close enough?
Well, what he meant by that was that we only had one DTC participant list in the record, and it was for a different date. It was for not the date that was relevant. If you added the participant lists, stockholders, and you added the 421, you got really close to the 500. And the issue is, what is the number on the relevant dates? That's why we asked for him. So there's an inference here that I suppose if the DTC participant list for a later date had showed there were only two participants and there wasn't any hope that Niagara would have 500 total stockholders, he might have denied it, is the way I viewed it. I see that I'm out of time.
Well, let me ask you a question on timing before you sit down. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, if we issued an order today ruling in your favor on all points, you probably couldn't do too much with the information between now and the 6th.
I could.
But I'm sure you would expend all of your energy doing something. But more realistically, as I understand it, you'd like an answer sometime in September so that you can either bring a suit while you're still a shareholder or seek to enjoin this proposed transaction that's going to close in October. Is that right?
The transaction must close by October under the document.
Exactly.
They could close the day after the 6th. I don't know. That's my concern. If the stockholders vote on it the 6th, it's often the practice that the board gets together and says, stockholders voted in favor of it, let's do the deal and close it, and they could close this thing September the 7th.
Okay.
Thank you.
The court directed a question to counsel about what Vice Chancellor Lamb said about the effective date of the splits. Vice Chancellor Lamb did, in fact, address that question. He said, and we cited it on the footnote on page 14 of our brief, as a matter of state law, of course, the stock split was effective the date it was stamped by the Secretary of State. That's what our law is. Your Honors, we're told, I think, that he didn't address that, and in fact, he did. Let me just take a moment, if I could, to address the case taken brought by the appellant, the cross appeal. I think it's important for this court to understand that what they really proved on the deregistration issue was nothing. This is different, obviously, than the re-registration point. A disagreement with the business judgment of this board. Their CEO testified that he had no facts, he had no evidence of a breach of care, of a breach of duty of loyalty, of any secret agenda on the part of Michael Scharf, on the part of Niagara or anybody else. No questions about independence, no questions about disinterestedness of this board, none whatsoever. Now, they've made up some new factors that they say the board should have considered. There is no evidence that the board didn't, in fact, consider every one of those factors. The factors that the board disclosed were obviously detailed and extensive. Mr. Obis, their CEO, testified he had no reason to believe that in fact Niagara's board didn't carefully consider every one of those. And of course, the list of factors includes a reference to the fact that other issues were considered as well. One brief point about the attack on Mr. Sharp. The suggestion is that he did the deregistration in order to drive down the stock price so that he could buy more stock. Two problems with that. Number one, he did the deregistration, didn't drive down the stock price. The stock price tripled. It jumped up threefold during the period of deregistration. Number two, the suggestion that he wanted to do it in order to buy more stock is utterly unsupported. The evidence shows that what Mr. Scharf bought after deregistration was shares comprising one-half of 1% of the issued and outstanding stock of the company. There is just no basis for the claim that Mr. Scharf or the board of directors of Niagara did anything improper in connection with the deregistration. As I said on the opening argument, they probably saved more, $2.5 million in the initial deregistration, with $750,000 in savings thereafter, which again, Mr. Obis acknowledged were ballpark accurate numbers, than they made during certain prior years. This was a really important event for this small company.
Were there any fractional shares that were bought out at a price that's substantially lower than the market price before the deregistration?
Your Honor, none that I know of. There was no evidence of that. I don't believe it was Your Honor's question before the deregistration or after?
Well, As I understood, part of the claim it was that there were certain shareholders, whether they were fractional shareholders or DTC or whatever, that after the reverse forward split, they were, in effect, cashed out. And they were cashed out at a number that was less than the market price.
No, sir. My response to that would be the following. What they did was have a pricing mechanism that followed the pricing mechanism approved by this court in the Avaya case.
I remember that.
Which was a market-driven pricing mechanism focused on a period of trading.
Was it a 10-day period or something?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Preceding, the split. So they followed that essentially like a cookbook, did exactly that. And every stockholder got I believe it was $8.47 a share that pricing formulation led to. So I don't think there's any issue there. And there were no fractionals that were bought out at any different price. No record of that I'm aware of at all, Your Honor. No issue there whatsoever.
Mr. Welch, if this is approved on the 6th and closes shortly thereafter, will this entire appeal be moot?
Your Honor, the court below said that it would. Mr. Weidinger said that it would. I'm in no position to disagree with that. That hasn't been briefed or argued, but again, I believe that those two positions are clear, and I'm in no position to dispute that. I would leave the court with the thought that there is no federal authority whatsoever authorizing any federal agency, organization, SEC, or anything else to reset a split, set properly under Delaware law.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent brief and for the argument today. We'll do the best we can within a rational time frame to get you an answer that would be helpful.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state and the honorable court.